Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 13th episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhurst. Today, I am joined by Dr. Kate Spradley.
Hi, I'm Kate Spradley. I'm an anthropology professor at Texas State University. I do a lot of work in humanitarian and human rights related to long-term missing and unidentified on the Texas-Mexico border. And I'm also very interested in population affinity estimation.
To discuss a paper she co-authored with Dr. Richard Jantz entitled, What Are We Really Estimating in Forensic Anthropological Practice? Population Affinity or Ancestry, from Volume 4, Number 4. So let's jump right in. Could you please briefly describe the article and give three main takeaways?
Sure. So lots of people say that we estimate ancestry, but when an American forensic anthropologist makes an estimation, we're really estimating local variation, not global variation. So the paper is really about exploring the uniqueness of the American population and what it is that we're really estimating. And three takeaways. The first is that the American population is differentiated from ancestral populations. So for example, African Americans are differentiated from Africans, European Americans differentiated from Europeans, and Mexican Americans differentiated from Mexicans. The second takeaway is that the American population is dynamic and ever-changing. And the third is that forensic anthropologists should understand population structure and assorted and mating practices in the United States.
So in the introduction, you guys detail how you're going through kind of the historical context of how we've developed this framework for thinking about ancestry estimation historically and the events that happened. In particular, I'm interested in how the modern synthesis eventually led to the new physical anthropology and what that means or what that meant for our field.
Sure. So the modern synthesis is really fundamental to biological anthropology. And the modern synthesis is a term that was coined by Julian Huxley and refers to the synthesis between Mendelian genetics and Darwin's theory of evolution. And Washburn introduced this concept, and he called it the new physical anthropology, and it came out in a 1951 paper suggesting that physical anthropologists should focus on the process and mechanisms of evolutionary change rather than sorting the results, rather than being typologists. So that was a real game changer. And then, of course, Fuentes came out in the 2000s talking about the new physical anthropology, you know, because after 50 years, you do need to update. After 70 years, you need to update.
So what are the differences between ancestry and population affinity? And is it possible to estimate both from an anthropological standpoint? And if so, are those independent estimates?
I think these are great questions, and I'm not going to overthink it. I'm going to try to keep this as simple as possible. So when I think about ancestry, it simply refers to ancestral origins. And population affinity is really getting at local variation, not global variation. And population affinity refers to a similarity of characteristics. In the forensic anthropology context, estimating population affinity means that you can go beyond ancestry and pick up on that local variation, which provides a more meaningful estimation. And is it possible to estimate both? And are these independent? It's certainly possible to estimate both, but whether or not they're independent, I think really depends on the question at hand and the purpose of the analysis and how much of what type of data you have. I think those are really central questions. Sometimes you may want to estimate ancestry. I can't imagine just estimating ancestry in the type of work that I do. For someone else, maybe so.
I guess, and to contextualize the work you do, it needs to be able to look at very regional, localized variation.
Right. I think you can do, you know, both at the same time. But I do think it depends on the question you're asking. I think for me, I've listened to a lot of my colleagues say that there's no way we can tell the difference between African American and African. Or I see a lot of people pooling African Americans and Africans to increase their sample size. And without really maybe thinking about what it is that they're doing or what question that they're asking. And in forensic anthropology in the United States, you know, are we trying to estimate if someone has ancestry in Africa? Are we trying to estimate if they were born and raised in the United States? I think the latter. That's why I think affinity is just a really more thoughtful estimation and is getting at what we're trying to estimate.
And as you insinuated, it is infinitely more helpful in identification effort too, because you can be very specific about it in that way.
Yes. Yes.
And in the type of questions you can ask with that in mind too, is going to inform how you construct your data sets. Like you said, you should not be pulling those things because that is essentially adding noise to your results. And it's giving you, if you're using, say, averages from those for any reason, it's going to throw them off to a huge degree, particularly if you try to leverage those in like a discriminant model or anything that's going to leverage means and distance from means to describe a person. And that's aside from the fact that I think comparing anything to a mean is wrong because means don't exist in biology anywhere.
I could not agree with you more. 100%. Averages, means, they don't exist. And that's one thing about geometric morphometric methods too. You're creating this geometric mean that exists nowhere. It's made up.
Yep. Yeah. So what is it we're comparing to? If that thing doesn't literally exist, why are we comparing it to it?
Right.
And that is then going to be defined by, at the lowest level, the data you're using. What data are describing this? How is this being constructed?
Yes, I think thinking about what you're doing is really important. And anytime we're estimating something, we're trying to answer a question. And we really got to think about what that question is, where in the world we are, and really understand whether or not we have the best data and the best reference groups, and if we're asking the right question.
Put simply, what are model-bound and model-free methods, and what are the relative costs, benefits of each?
Okay, so model-bound methods incorporate theoretical models to estimate evolutionary processes such as gene flow and genetic drift, like estimating rates of admixture. And model-free methods explore population structure and describe the pattern of differentiation without testing explicit hypotheses about evolutionary processes. Regarding the cost benefits, if you want to know how populations are structured, which I think most forensic anthropologists do, we're not trying to estimate admixture. I mean, that certainly plays into the application of forensic anthropology. But if we want to know how populations are structured, model-free methods work really well. They're also, I think, conceptually a lot easier. Not that you should just do something because it's easier.
Are there any confounding factors practitioners should consider when estimating affinity? Or, put another way, how does one conduct a thoughtful analysis?
Well, I think asking if there are confounding factors to consider is a pretty loaded question. I think there are many factors, confounding factors. Number one, I think you should ask, what is the main question at hand? You know, are you estimating for a biological profile? Are you estimating for a historic case, prehistoric remains? Then I think everyone needs to understand the basics of the data and the method that they're going to use. I think we make a lot of assumptions that we're using the right data or that we're using the right method, but are we? Sometimes I see people using multiple methods to estimate affinity. I'm not in favor of using multiple methods unless you have a fragmentary data source and you really need to. It's probably because of my statistical upbringing in graduate school. I think, you know, you need to know how to interpret the statistical output. I think everyone needs to actually read the help files that are associated with each program, read the user's manual. It is not just there to take up space. The user's manual, the help files have really great information on how to thoughtfully use that program and interpret the results. So it's not based on experience. You know, you don't have to rely on your instructor's experience. You need, and I say a lot of this as a professor who has taught a lot of students, read the user's manual, read the help file. I think that's one way to conduct a thoughtful analysis. But also really understand the reference populations when we're estimating the affinity of an unknown. Understand the reference populations and whether or not they're appropriate. We need to understand where we are in the world, what kind of questions we're answering.
I love that. What's your personal hang-up about multiple estimates?
Well, if you have a complete skull, or even with the pelvis for sex. I mean, I think that we probably can all agree that the pelvis is the best estimator for sex, right? If you have a pelvis, if it's 100% complete, you get a good estimation on that. Do you need to go to the cranium to provide a secondary backup? Do you need to go to long bones to provide a secondary backup? I don't know. I think these are questions that should be answered. Same with affinity estimation. If you're using metrics, and it answers your question, do you also really need to use another method? to answer your question? I'll tell you where this comes from. When I took statistics at the University of Tennessee, I was taught by Dr. Schmidhammer. And Dr. Schmidhammer's wife had a poodle that could sit, stand, and roll over. And if you said sit, it would sit, stand, and roll over. If you said stand, it would sit, stand, and roll over. If you said roll over, it would sit, stand, and roll over. So he would always give us a question and he would say, give me the answer. Don't tell me everything you know. Just answer the question. You could answer it multiple ways. Just answer it with one. So I think this is what heavily influences me. And then what do you do if the results are conflicting? Then do you have to write more paragraphs about why they don't agree? And how does that look on a report?
Oh, yeah, I agree in that particular instance, too. And there's no way to understand the overall error associated with combining these different methods. And
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I wonder if a lot of it's just kind of to make us feel less uncertain about what we're doing, right? We're trying to look for consistency. And is that then not some level of confirmation bias, right?
Right.
We know we have the skull, and the skull has the most plastic information contained within it, which we know has been studied. Why would we conflate it by throwing in a bunch of weird stuff that has very low discriminant, if any, power to it?
Right.
It's going to give conflicting results. I would say the only thing I can think of as a practical example are things like seeing the expression of morphological characteristics in the teeth versus the head, right? They might say different things like Asian teeth, European head, and in my anthropology is like, that's Southwest Hispanic, right?
I think that's a really interesting, and that's something that I was hoping that we would get to when I mentioned for affinity estimation that you should understand your data. I think that we still don't know, are teeth telling us the same thing that craniometrics tell us? Are they telling us the same thing, or are they telling us two different things with metric and non-metric? And I think these really need to be explored. So absolutely, there might be some confounding issues there where that particular example might actually warrant some other method. Or if you have just a tooth, or if you have fragmentary data, you may want something else to back that up if you have inconclusive results.
I mean, I wish someone would do that study. I'm thinking, was it Rob Cornicini? Someone in like the 80s did a utility of craniometrics versus dental metrics, maybe?
Yes. Yes, there have been a few studies. Not very often do they use matched data sets. I don't recall if that study used matched data sets, but the ones that do, I think, are the most powerful. I think we should all be putting up the data that we use for papers and make it available.
Yeah.
And you will find that there is data in this paper that is available for download on Zenodo.
It is a really impressive data set, and it is available to download. I'm thinking, in particular, why no Europeans from the von Luschan collection?
So the data from the von Luschan collection came from me collecting dissertation data, and my dissertation focused mostly on craniofacial secular change in the African diaspora. So when I went to the AMNH, I was focused on West Africans.
So if forensic anthropologists are working within a medical legal framework, should we be using terms outlined by the OMB statistical directive number 15 just to be consistent?
I really think it's important to be able to work within our current federal missing and unidentified persons system, like NAMIS, which is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, which is compulsory in many states. Many states are passing laws that make it compulsory to enter cases into NAMIS, which is very good. And NAMIS uses these OMB categories. I don't think these are the only categories that we have to use. I think we have to be able to speak many languages when it comes to terminology. But I think using this is very helpful because NAMIS is a relational database that is used to find potential matches. And when I was a PhD student at the University of Tennessee, we would write a forensic anthropology report and hand it off to law enforcement, and they would enter it into NCIC. But now you have forensic anthropologists that are really taking the lead on these long-term missing and unidentified cases. And we can enter these cases into NAMIS. We can follow up with these cases and help lead to case resolution. And I think this is a huge game changer So being able to work within that system, I think, is important. You have the option to check multiple boxes. You have an option to check unsure. And you have an option to write in further notes about the case as well. I don't feel you have to check one box and let that be it, which would, because not everybody fits neatly into one box.
Yeah, yeah. That's too typological of a situation. However, I'm thinking for if you're writing case reports for law enforcement, and then you do whatever you want. If you want to do ancestry or affinity, however you structured your analysis, but then you can make an opinion like this might fit into this SNB category, OMB category.
Right.
Right. Like right. You have an opinion about it.
Right. Absolutely. So if you're, you know, I it's probably no surprise. I use Crini Metrics and I use Vordask.
No.
I know this is shocking information. So if someone classifies as a Guatemalan, I will say that they were from a similar to Guatemalan group, but this would be considered Hispanic in the United States.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And in our search for absolute answers, we forget how much information, contextual information is important in these instances.
Yes.
So we got to take those blinders off.
Yes.
Conceptually, what are Mahalanobis distance and FST, and what unique insight can each statistic give us?
Mahalanobis distance allows us to look at population structure and to see what groups are more similar to each other and what groups are more dissimilar to one another. Whereas FST really speaks to the amount of variation within or between groups.
So when we look at these, they're in a symmetrical matrix where each group is depicted, and you're looking at a comparison between two groups. And one is telling you how similar or different they are, and that is the D square. So the higher the value, the more divergent the groups, or the more dissimilar they are. Whereas the more FST you see talks about the amount of variability within that group. How much does this group vary? And what we're looking for, if we're thinking about homogeneous groups, are very small FST and very large Mahalanobis distances. Would that be a fair?
Yes. Well said, Mike.
So what unique information does the discriminant function presented in Table 6 add to what was observed in the D square or in the biodistance analyses?
Well, this was something that was Richard's idea, and I think it was a really good idea because Table 6 provides a classification matrix. The other tables are describing the population structure and variation. And so Table 6 is really an application of what we learned about the structure. We can see that African Americans, European Americans, and Mexican Americans are differentiated from their ancestral groups, but how well are they going to classify? You know, we're putting it into the applied anthropology realm. And it shows that African Americans have very few misclassifications as West Africans, and the same for European Americans and Europeans, which is really supporting the notion that we can estimate that local variation and how unique the American population really is. I mean, I think the questions of why Americans are so unique is a really interesting question. That's not the purpose of the paper, but I think that is the purpose that is perhaps the most interesting. But I love the application. That's why I love working with recent modern groups, because you can ask really interesting questions, but you can also apply that knowledge for practical purpose.
Given everything you know, what is it we are estimating?
Well, I think that's a big question, and I don't think we can definitively answer anything here today, but I'll tell you that I feel we're estimating how similar an unknown is to various reference groups that are presumably thoughtfully assembled for comparison based on what question a forensic anthropologist is asking and where they are in the world. So I really think in the case of the United States forensic anthropologist, most of us are estimating affinity. We're not estimating ancestry. We want to get at that most local variation. I try to ask myself all the time, what is it that we're doing? What are we estimating? Do we have the appropriate data? Are we using the appropriate measurements? Are we asking the right questions? And are we really doing this in a thoughtful way? I mean, you really have to think about it and understand it and read those help files.
Yeah, you need that baseline level of understanding about what it is you're doing, even if it's conceptually. I don't care that you memorize the math behind it. I don't.
Sure. Conceptually, you need to. It doesn't matter if you can program it yourself or if you can do the analysis yourself, but at the very least, you need to understand conceptually what is happening in there.
Yeah. The biggest thing I see is someone will use a real measurement, like a max cranial breath, and it'll be real. It'll be really huge for no reason. They'll throw it in and they're like, well, it's a relatively low weighted, but it's over 3 standard deviations away. And they're like, it was stepwise selected. I should leave it in. I was like, well, that's an unfair comparison. What you're doing actually is comparing something we don't know to everything we know. That is outside the realm of everything we know. And even though it might say it has low model importance, just because this is based off of exploiting means, that's going to throw it somewhere into space that makes no sense.
Right.
Because it's an unfair comparison.
Yes.
But people do it all the time because they don't think about it.
Yeah.
Where do you fall on the, do you like a multi-iteration approach? Do you start with all-inclusive groups or all possible groups? And do you whittle down based off of the low typicality, low posterior?
That's what I teach. Yes.
Yeah.
Is that what I do? Yes, typically. It depends on the question at hand, but I usually do start with everything. Yes.
Yeah.
As the user's manual suggests. Yeah.
It does. The only deviation I'll have is that I will not remove a group unless it is atypical.
Yeah.
Even if it was the lowest posterior, if it's still typical, I have no, at least mathematical reason to do it. And if I'm using that to be a guide for my decision making, then I can't throw it out.
Yeah.
Just so I can get a better prediction in the end.
Meaning
you get what more optimistic model results. It's not better.
Yes.
Answer your question. It's not good.
Yeah. I mean, I see some students, you know, when I talk about this, they take it down to just two groups. I'm like, whoa, wait a second. We don't need to. Yeah. Let's not take it that far. So I think there is really a danger in that. So
The danger in that. And then again, you're not encapsulating how much overall error you have in your final estimate at that point.
Right.
Are there any future directions for this research?
That's a great question. You know, I think in my mind, there are many future directions for this research. How much time do I have to do them? Not that much. So I think maybe these are future directions for willing graduate students. But I think that further explorations of the American population groups, we need more data. You know, in this paper, we only had data for African Americans, European Americans, and a really small sample of Mexican Americans. Left out were Asian Americans. We just don't have the skeletal data for Asian-born Americans. You know, I think there's a lot more explorations to do with this. And also to address the questions of, you know, why the American groups are differentiated. That wasn't a big focus of this paper, but I think that would be a really interesting future direction of this.
Looking back, if you were to start over, is there anything you would have done differently with this paper?
I would have proofed it for typos better, for starters. You know, I reread it for this podcast and I just saw all kinds of typos and I'm thinking, why didn't I recognize this before, you know, when we were in the production phase. I would clarify a few things here and there better. And I would have also included the Mexican Americans in table 6. I think we have the European Americans and African Americans. They provided the most straightforward examples for that. Mexican Americans have more complex population history and population structure.
Is there anything important about this paper that you think might get overlooked by readers?
That the American population is unique and can be differentiated from ancestral groups. And that this local variation is really what we're trying to estimate in the United States.
Yeah, and that it can and should be investigated by people that are curious to look into it, because there could be a million reasons why, you know, and I'm sure there's data sets out there that would help support that. Specifically, I'm thinking incorporating GIS stuff just because I'm familiar with GIS. And I think there's always a spatial component to it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think I told Steve and Heather that my model for affinity is spatial autocorrelation plus xenophobia.
Oh, I think that's great.
Such a nerdy thing to say to somebody.
Oh, yeah, but it's perfect. It's really perfect.
Okay, last two. What type of studies do you think are missing from the field currently?
Well, it might sound like a broken record here, but I think that we need to know what different kinds of data are telling us about population relationships. Do they all provide the same information about population structure? What's the best type of data to use? And, you know, the question of should we use more than one method? I think those would be great questions to explore. And are we using the best measurements?
I agree. I mean, we have so much data now. You can measure an entire skeleton, take all the dental things, all the morphoscopics, right, if you want. You throw it into one cohesive model. You could do that. It's
right.
Possible. Why not?
Right.
Why just right. use one thing?
Right.
If we're establishing individual identity, why would we try to get as vague as we can and use as little as we can?
Right. I think using multiple data types could be really important, especially once we can use matched data sets to figure out, you know, are they really telling us the same thing, or are there, you know, what's contributing the most? And can we skim that off the top of all the different data types and put that into a good model?
Yeah. Or otherwise, how can we best exploit and leverage this observed variation in the most meaningful way?
Yes. I like the way you said it. Yeah.
So last thing, is there anything you'd like to promote, give a shout out, things you're working on, projects you're passionate about? And we can include links in the description as well.
So sure, thanks. I'd like to promote a project I direct called Operation Identification. It was founded to facilitate the identification and repatriation of unidentified human remains found along the South Texas-Mexico border. And we do this through community outreach, scientific analysis, and collaboration with a lot of really wonderful governmental and non-governmental organizations. And if you want to check out some of the things we do, you can look up Operation Identification on our Facebook page, and you can learn about ways that you could support us and help us out.
Many thanks to Kate Spradley for taking the time to chat, and to you for listening. Please check the links in the episode description for the dataset used in this study, graciously provided by Drs. Spradley and Jantz, as well as links to Operation ID. Be good.